Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight number 533 for comics originally released on October 25th, 2017. Now, starting us off in DC is Suicide Squad number 28. This is part two of the secret history of Task Force X. Task Force X is the alternate name of the Suicide Squad, so why they didn't just say the secret history of the Suicide Squad, I don't know, but okay. And I don't think on the cover it was blatantly obvious it was part two. In the solicit, though, it was. And I was curious about this because they had mentioned two returning characters, or long-lost DC characters. Have you been reading Suicide Squad throughout, or is this one you're on and off of?
Yeah, this is one I'm on and off on.
How far back do you go with the Suicide Squad, just in general?
Never been a fan. Just sampled from here and there. It never really caught on for me.
How far back, even with that, though?
The New 52.
Okay, New 52. Reason I ask that is back with the 80s with, trying to think if it came out of Legends or what sort of cut point at DC it came out of. They had, at that point, the new take of the Suicide Squad, where it's kind of sort of the Dirty Dozen for supervillains of they take, Amanda Waller takes villains out of prison, puts a bomb in their head and says, you're gonna go do this for King and Country kind of a thing. And if you don't, we'll blow you up. So, you know, you got the reluctant heroes in the most reluctant of senses. Prior to that, there was a different Suicide Squad. I mention that because the secret history of Task Force X reaches pretty far back. Because this villainous, you know, take of the Suicide Squad goes back like 30 years. And this issue has some upsides, has some downsides. I really would not recommend this for somebody who wants to try out the Suicide Squad. It is not a good jumping on point. In the storyline, the current Suicide Squad is kind of split in half onto two different teams. One half is in space with the two members of the original Suicide Squad. The other is fighting, what, zombie robots or whatever on an airfield. And frankly, I really don't think any of the members of the current Suicide Squad really get a chance to kind of shine and be, I don't say heroic because they're villains, but you know what I mean.
Maybe Katana, but she's only, that's really only a page or two.
She gets a little bit, Harley gets a little bit, I mean, they all get some screen time, but none of it where I think somebody's come out saying, wow, I really want to follow that character. They're great.
And yeah, some of them's just a panel.
Yeah, some of them are window dressing, and what little, I hesitate to use the term characterization they got in the previous issue, is kind of disregarded here. They're pawns in the story. They're not participants. And the crux of this issue is dealing with a leftover threat from the original Suicide Squad, the, what did they call it? The Red Wave Monster, which isn't, frankly, even what I think they would have called it back in the day. And it seemed to be just a, we need a threat from the old school to throw in, so let's make one up and, we'll go with this. But it's not a bad comic. But it's exploring a history of Task Force X, the Greater Suicide Squad stuff, that really wasn't, in my mind, calling out to be explored. And given that we've rebooted the universe with the New 52, done a soft reboot, retooling, whatever you want to call it, with Rebirth, going back to comics that literally were coming out in, like, the 60s and whatnot, and bringing those characters back, it's not a mistake, but it felt odd. And, I mean, I've read some reprints of the original Suicide Squad stuff, but, I mean, even that was ages ago, and I have vague recollections of it. And, again, the villains recruited for missions has been the take on the Suicide Squad for literally a generation, for like 30 years now. And when you pull up characters anchored in World War II and thereabouts, really, we've gotten to the point where they had to insert another Rick Flag into his family history. Such that the original Rick Flag, who was, at one point, the only Rick Flag of the Suicide Squad back in the day, became the father of the one who was running the villainous one. Now he's become the grandfather of the one who had just been on the team, but they recently killed off. because we can't have too many of these guys running around. This might have had a little bit more resonance if they hadn't just killed off the previous, or not the previous, the current Rick Flag, and gone to not the previous, but the previous to the previous, the grandfather Rick Flag. I mean, this whole thing is, I don't want to say nonsensical, but it's like, why are you bringing this in? And again, it felt like they put the core characters of this title on supporting cast status for the most part. And too much of this issue was setting up and explaining the nature and the history of the threat and really not moving things forward enough for me.
Yeah, the it was curious, this Red Wave monster, which was kind of the whole crux of why the plot was happening at all, it didn't really come across as being incredibly universe threatening to me. They didn't do a good job of selling that as, you know, we've all got to band together or it's just going to destroy the entire world. And I thought that was kind of a miss there. And it was kind of borne out with Katana's character saying, that's a great story, Grandpa, but I don't have a bomb in my head, so we're not going anywhere. And I was kind of hoping we'd go down that road because that would have kind of been a little more interesting to me. We're not going to do this. That was a great story, but nobody cares. And goodbye. Mm-hmm. But to actually capitulate to it, and he had his little hero moment there at the end, and he's going to sacrifice himself, and we'll see where that goes. But it's okay. Like you said, it's not a bad comic. It's not awesome, and I don't know who's going, man, I really wish you'd revisit some of this stuff from, is it Silver Age, would you say?
Yeah.
So Silver Age era, and tell some more stories with these characters, because they're not that interesting. And we have much more interesting members of the Suicide Squad now. So that was one of the lessons that I learned from reading this is, I'm glad I never read any of that old stuff, because what a boring group of people that would have been to read about. It's much more interesting now.
I think that's a little unfair because you're taking some very colorful supervillains and comparing them to a group of quote unquote regular human adventurers that were going up against alien threats and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of fun stories you can do, and the characters become interesting when they're having to fight completely out of their league, these aliens and these other monsters and stuff, with just kind of regular technology or whatever. It was a bit more grounded of a story back then.
It's Star Trek then.
I would say more Stargate than Star Trek. The key difference being Star Trek takes place in the future. They've got phasers, they've got transporters, they've got technobabble. Stargate is like modern soldiers and stuff having to deal with this stuff and picking up the tools and widgets along the way from alien races or whatnot.
Yeah, I will defer to you in all things nerdy sci-fi. You win.
That wasn't the point, but thank you. Compared to the supervillains, yeah, the old crew look kind of boring. They're just regular folk. But that's not to say that when they're the star of their own book in the period, if you'd read the original stuff, maybe you'd like it, maybe you wouldn't, but they become more interesting characters in that frame of reference. And some of those stories are more akin to kind of this two-page backup feature we're getting, which is the actual history of the original Suicide Squad and kind of some backstory or whatever on King Faraday, which I thought was a little interesting to really be anchoring all of that just post-World War II, because it means you can't do kind of current versions of some of these characters. And King Faraday, for instance, I thought we had a current version of, but it's gotten to the point I can't keep track if I'm thinking New 52 or pre-New 52 or whatever. They've retold some of these sorts of stories and reorigined some of these characters so many times that the boundaries between the timelines or whatever is blurred for me, and it's easy for me to get a little confused on that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's unfair to take those two pages and assume that's the storytelling style of the previous iteration. So, yeah.
It's absolutely not. But you've got to keep in mind that the original Suicide Squad was one of these regular human teams or whatever that was coming out around the same time as Cave Carson and those guys, the Sea Devils, the original Secret Six, Rip Hunter and his group of Time Commandos or whatever they were. Did you read the Scooby-Doo team up with the Challengers?
No. And everything you mentioned, never read any of that.
All of those characters, though, while they would fit in the Saturday morning type stuff, and they were great back in the 60s and reprints thereof, that's not what we're reading these days. So why bring this stuff back into the DC universe and anchor it, you know, two generations back, effectively? If there's payoff for this, I'm all for it. I've got nothing against the World War II era, and particularly the World War II era of DC, but my love of it is essentially the Roy Thomas version of it. And I was reading that, frankly, before even this take on the Suicide Squad happened. So it was one of those things where you could have the kids of the JSA, now you must have the grandkids of, for it to be contemporary stories with a story element anchored in World War II era. So it's not a bad comic. It has some fun stuff, but it does come across a little bland because the usage of the original Suicide Squad members is not exciting, and they don't really use the current Suicide Squad in a particularly exciting manner either.
Yeah, I think that's where I'm at. It's not awful, but it didn't really do much for me. Didn't move the needle. Didn't make me want to read any more Suicide Squad. And I'm not really that interested in the Red Wave monster and finding out what happens there. So it's just a C minus for me, but it's okay. You might like it more.
I went with a C plus, but things like the Red Wave monster, that felt like a filler, like something that's just, well, we need a threat. We'll go with this.
It didn't we'll put this inspired. In there as a placeholder for now. We'll come up with something better. And then nobody ever went back and replaced that with something better.
It's like, oh yeah, the script's due tomorrow. Yeah, that's kind of how I felt. Shall we go on to our Marvel book?
Yeah.
This is U.S. Avengers number 11. This one was one I wanted to do for two reasons. One, actually a couple of reasons. First, the title of the story is Cannonball Run. I love the movie. This has nothing to do with that, but what the hell. It's part one of the storyline. Two, it's dealing with what happened to Cannonball, because he was recently missing and presumed dead during Secret Empire, I guess. So now we find out what happens. And three, the cover of this has him in a quasi-photorealistic look with a almost Dan DiCarlo style Archie-esque soda shop. Just feeling completely out of place, almost to the point of like a Roger Rabbit sort of a deal.
I was curious when you pitched this one. I thought, huh, we just reviewed this not that long ago, and it was a big stinker. And so I was like, wonder why we're revisiting this so soon.
Did the first issue.
Yeah.
It was back at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Still awful. But then, you know, I noticed, oh, it's kind of a Archie riff. That could be interesting. And it was interesting. It made up for what it usually is, I think. So I think that it improved it by smashing up the genre a little bit.
I'm not going to pretend that U.S. Avengers is the be-all, end-all Avenger title or even close to the front-runner of the franchise. The mix of characters is, Citizen V, which is really Sunspot. So you got two of the original New Mutants of Sunspot and Cannonball, and then a bunch of effectively either knockoff or second, third-rate characters, you know, a Red Hulk who's not the Red Hulk you would think of, Iron Patriot who's not the Iron Patriot you would think of, Squirrel Girl who is the Squirrel Girl you would think of, she's the one and the only so far, given time, there'll be another, and then Enigma who's another kind of derivative almost character. But because they're dealing with these, they can go and do some fun stuff. And it turns out that Cannonball has found himself trapped on an alien planet in what looks like small town USA, a mock-up or whatever of that. It's very clearly not a real thing, and it's got a distinctly Archie vibe to it, I think, is understating it. It's got a huge aspect of that. And the way they tell the story, now they don't actually say this, but my feeling is this presumably was like a training town for Skrulls pre-Secret Invasion. And then at one point we actually see a character that I thought was very obviously a Super Skrull with the powers of, Cyclops, Colossus, Nightcrawler, and Archangel, which seemed to actually surprise Cannonball a bit, which confused me because, again, there were Super Skrulls out the wazoo during Secret Invasion. But it's something where, just like in they had, you know, the Russian America towns where they would train people to be spies, that's kind of what I took this to be, and then somebody took it over and presumably had watched too many of, I guess, televised, what is this character's name? Richie Redwood, in place of Archie Andrews. And they modeled the whole town and everything off of that, and everybody seems to be a prisoner of his, and he wants them to stay in character. He wants to live out this idealized television reality. And it's fun, because you've got characters that are essentially Betty and Veronica. You've got Gary instead of Reggie, Biff instead of Moose, which I thought was a kind of a fun potential Back to the Future homage there. It's just, it's got a whimsicalness to it, yet there's a little bit of an undercurrent of Cold War kind of spy stuff potentially going on. I'll admit I didn't care for the alien gangster robots that the rest of the team deals with, but it kind of fit the tone of the story, so it wasn't a big deal. While I think this got this arc off to a little bit of a slow start, it was fun. And just seeing kind of the riff on the Archie stuff, with a bit of a dark undercurrent of don't tick off Archie, you'll get in trouble sort of a thing, or Richie in this case. Which again, Richie Cunningham, again, some of the names they used I thought were well chosen. I enjoyed this. I thought it was a blast.
Yeah, the one thing, I had a problem with Paco Diaz's interpretation of Squirrel Girl again. I don't know if he was the artist back in number one, but the one thing I recall being egregious was that it drew her as some kind of supermodel, and she clearly isn't in her title, and she's drawn, well, it's her title. They should really take the lead from the person who's writing her book.
I get what you're saying, but if you go not to the original stuff, but to some of the intervening stuff, she looked a lot like this there in New Avengers and some other stuff. I mean, I get what you're saying. They're inconsistent with the look of the character. She's got her own title. That should be the go-to reference.
That should be the character design. And at least a variation in interpretation of the artist based on the character design that's in the current book. You shouldn't be able to have this much creative license with a team book. It should be in the ballpark.
I find that frustrating. I agree with you, but I at least see where this artist got the reference from.
Right, but you shouldn't go back multiple volumes. You should stay in the current volume.
Given how long some volumes last, that may be the only Squirrel Girl reference he had. But I'm not disagreeing with your point at all. And this is something that it would, you know, the editor probably should have supplied the artist with, this is how the character looks in her own book. Whether they want to make it match or not, don't know. But I agree with expecting it to match is not unreasonable in the least. It makes perfect sense. I agree with what you're saying.
But, I mean, that's a quibble. It's only one of the characters in the book. The other ones I was fine with. They were close enough for me. And I liked the Archie riff. I thought it was interesting. I'm curious enough to actually want to see how they get out of this scrape. And who all the rest of the characters are in this prison cell. I'm not familiar enough with the archetypes that they've got there to figure it out on my own. So I'm looking forward to meeting all of them and seeing how they get out of this. So it did a good job of taking a property that I did not like, rejiggering it a little bit, and putting a new package on it that made me a little more interested. So, I think that's a win. So it was a fun read.
Yeah, I definitely think, this is probably a better jumping on point than some of the other stuff, of the title. I've enjoyed the run of US Avengers, but it's not the Avenger title most people are going to gravitate towards because there's nobody in here that I think anybody would recognize and say, you know what? That's one of the characters I think of when I think of the Avengers. Mm-mm. But it was fun. So I enjoyed this quite a bit. For me, it was a very solid B. I'm looking forward to what they do. And it's not something that I think is going to last in terms of these other supporting characters and whatnot beyond this arc. But, you know, who knows? Maybe they'll find a way to take one or two of the characters and have him join the team temporarily or something. Stranger things have happened.
Yeah, it was a good jumping on point for new readers. I felt it was, and it was fun, especially if you like Archie and that world. I think that would help you kind of latch onto this story. So I also gave it a B.
Well, one of the things that was fun about the use of the Archie stuff is they did a riff on it, holding true to the tenets of that framework without poking fun at it and making it seem childish or ludicrous or anything like that. And they were, I would say, surprisingly respectful of the franchise. So I was pleased with that. Again, it's, if you're reading Archie, this is worth checking out. If you're not reading Archie, that's worth checking out too, actually. It's really good stuff. So yeah, we'll see where they go with this. Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah.
This is Star Trek Boldly Go, number 13. This is part of the IDIC Part 1 storyline that is Infinite Diversity and Infinite Combinations. This is an arc I've been looking forward to since they announced it. It's part 1 of 6 of a 6-issue mega event, whatever the hell that means. To me, that's a 6-issue story arc, but hey, mega event sounds impressive. And in this, scores of realities collide. As Infinite Diversities and Infinite Combinations takes on a new meaning for Captain Kirk and his crew with the fate of all realities at stake. It's like, well, that seems like a big deal. And each issue is going to delve into a different section of the multiverse, some we've seen, some we haven't. And I like alternate timelines. They can be fun for stories and stuff. Star Trek has certainly had many of them, the Mirror Universe being one of the two go-to examples. I would say the other is either the movie universe or the TV universe, depending where you came in. But the fact that they've got different timelines and can have fun with it is cool. And for Star Trek, though, it can be hard to find kind of a new variation to explore because they've done, I don't even remember how many seasons they've done. Let's see. 3 of the original series, 7 of Next Gen, Deep Space Nine and Voyager, another 4 of Enterprise. They're halfway through 1 of Discovery. They've also done an animated series that lasted a season or two, I think. Plus they've had the movies, plus the novels. The novels they've gone and done literally hundreds of those. So, I mean, Star Trek's pretty well mined. I've watched all the TV stuff. I've watched the movies. I've read many of the novels, a surprising number, but nowhere near all of them. They come out too fast. So I was thinking if they can find a new take on this for a universe, that'll be fun. Don't know if they can do that or not, but sure enough, they did. When we got the one where, and it's fun because they're riffing on, again, the movie stuff, which is the basis for this series. We've got one where this Spock, the Quinto Spock, was raised by humans, having been essentially rejected by the Vulcans. So we've got a much more emotional kind of a Spock versus a logic-driven Spock, and how that kind of played out differently in the timeline. And then having Kirk, having been raised by Vulcans, or not Vulcans, Klingons, I mean, was fascinating. So just this timeline that they set up here was a ton of fun. And then having the classic movie timeline they've established in the 3 movies intersecting with it, and then another crew, which is essentially just a gender-reversed one that we've seen in these comics before, that was cool too. I'm curious where they go with this, what other timelines we'll see, how they interact, and kind of what the core problem is, because this is part 1 of 6, and there's a lack of clarity as to what's really going to put the all realities at stake or whatever. But it was fun. They covered, I felt, a lot of ground here. They fleshed out these versions of these characters in this human-raised Spock timeline. And I enjoyed it. It was fun.
Yeah, I have a couple art problems here. Again, more quibbles. It's an interpretation of the movie likenesses, and it's pretty close. And so I guess that's good. I guess you want the fans of the movie to be able to enjoy that. The guy who plays Chekhov, who died, makes an appearance. That took me right out of the story. I think he's got to be recast. I think you definitely need to kind of move away from that character because he's not going to be in the movies anymore, right?
Disagree with that. They're not going to recast him from the movies. Chekhov, my understanding, will just be assigned elsewhere. And this is a way to use that character and pay respect to the actor and stuff for the impact he had in the course of the three movies and stuff. I didn't find him being in there the least bit of a problem. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I definitely think they should send him on assignment somewhere and get him off the screen. I thought that was a problem. I thought it was a lot of fun with the cooler Spock with the swoopy hair and the cropped ears. I mean that was a nice interpretation. I kind of wish this wasn't launching while that mirror storyline is going on. I kind of wish that they'd finish that up. It's the same publisher, right? Is it IDW?
The same publisher, but the Mirror One, Mirror Broken or whatever, is a next-gen story.
Yeah, so it's kind of mining that same area.
Fair enough.
I kind of wish that they would finish that up, let that storyline run its course in a different alternate take, and then maybe kick off this. I think the timing's a little off for it, and it could be problematic for confusion and folks. It's multiple. It's different tracks.
Yeah, but it's also possible that that one could end on a note that finishes that storyline and leaves those characters available to cross over into this in a few issues.
Before the, because it's a 6-issue, and I think it's 4 in, correct?
Yeah.
So it has a possibility to end and then make an appearance on here, which that would be really clever if they do that, but I don't see that happen.
That involves time travel as well as alternate timelines, so I don't know that they'll do that either.
Yeah. I thought the Kirk interpretation was really fun as well, and they did a good job of introducing him. They did a good job of introducing Spock, the new version of Spock and the new version of Kirk as well, and I thought they really showed you who their characters were in a fun way. That was kind of the standout parts of this for me. Because it got towards the end of this first issue and ships started interacting, and we get the gender swap, which was really only on it for a panel, so it'll kind of launch us into what's coming next. Yeah, I feel like that kind of scene has been played a little bit multiple times, so I'm not sure where they're going to go with this kind of standoff, but it was not a bad start. Pretty interesting storyline, and with the photorealism aside, I thought this was a pretty fun start to the story.
On the art thing, there are a couple of places where I thought they caught the essence of the actor without a dead-on likeness, which is good. There were a few places where I felt like on one panel we got like a really good rendition of one character, but then the panel next to it, not so much. It happened in a few places. Overall, I thought the art was good. There were one or two where it was a little stiff. But I think the challenge you have with anything based on a live-action property is how close do you get to the likeness? How close do you want to get to the likeness? And there's a challenge there that's a bit harder and different than just doing like a Batman or Avengers comic or whatever. You know, you've got some serious leeway as to how you depict Bruce Wayne or Spider-Man or whomever. But when you're doing the new movies based Spock or Bones or Kirk or whatever, you're expecting it to look a lot more like those actors. There's a need for a reference, and there's a risk of stillness and stiffness and lifelessness. To me, that's something that it's hard for an artist to really utterly nail that perfectly, and I think this artist does a great job throughout. A couple of panels less so, a couple of panels even more so. But it's a nice, clean, rendered style, and to me, it's I think IDW has been doing a terrific job with the Star Trek franchise and keeping the movie universe going between movies, and a lot of the stuff they're doing with some of the other books, just keeping the franchise kind of up and going. They're going to have a Star Trek Discovery title out before too long. I'm looking forward to that, too. This was a ton of fun. I'm going to go with a solid B on this, and I recommend it.
Yeah, I liked it too. I'm going to give it a B. I think it's fun, especially if you like the latest Star Trek movies. I think you'll enjoy this. And it did what, 100 million? The latest movie did 100 million. So that's a lot more people than read comics. At least read Star Trek comics. So if they venture forth into a comic shop, you want to give them something that they recognize. So yeah. Makes sense to me. Not that it ever works that way, but it'd be nice to give it the option.
But that's the thing, is it doesn't have to work entirely. It just needs a fraction of a percent to do it to have a meaningful bump. It still doesn't happen, but it could.
Yep, we keep holding out hope.
Yeah. So I've...
You're all caught up.
Oh, yeah, no, not
you're
even
current.
Close.
Oh.
Some point I'll say that, not this week. I read about 47 or so comics, which is roughly how many I got last week, so I'm kind of holding even right around that 200 comic level. Got about that many coming in my next shipment, so it just comes down to how much time I've got to read. We've got a holiday coming up at work for, I don't know, some bank holiday or whatever, so maybe that'll give me a little bit more reading time, don't know. It's just there's so many comics coming out. It's hard to keep up.
Well, hopefully you get caught up by the end of the year because it's November. So every November we put out a list of categories on the comic book page forum about the year in review, year in weekly comic spotlight, where John and I discuss our favorites of the year in a bunch of different categories and some cool miscellaneous categories as well. We're going to be putting that out. Maybe even by the time this episode airs, it will already be on the forum. But the fun thing is you get to play along. John and I give you our thoughts, as well as listeners on the forum get to weigh in with their favorite series and comics of the year in a variety from a variety of different publishers. And it's always a fun episode to do, a long episode to do, but it's always a lot of fun to kind of hear the diverse reading habits of folks and what stands out for our different listeners. And usually one or two sticks out and puts yet another comic on our reading lists and puts it on our radar that maybe it wasn't there before. So it's always fun to kind of see what stood out for folks over the course of the year.
Well, yeah, it's a good chance to kind of take that step back, get out of kind of the weekly what came out, what's coming out next month sort of a thing, and just look back over the course of the calendar year and what stood out, what do you remember, what did you, you know, think favorably of, what do you wish they would do, those sorts of things. And again, like you mentioned, there have been a couple of things that people have had as the best of the year that had not hit my radar, and it's like, oh, I should check that out. And, well, like Scooby-Doo Team-Up's a great example of that. I'm loving that book. Wouldn't be reading it if it wasn't for these episodes and people submitting what they thought was the best, or their favorites at the very least. Best is subjective. Favorites, that's, hey, you've got your favorites. There's nothing right or wrong about that. Everybody's got different stuff, and that's why having listener participation in this is so great. Is it'd be one thing if it was just me and Drew doing it or whatever, but you'd get his views, you get my views, and that's about it. I want to hear everybody's. It's there's just so much stuff out there that everybody loves something, and I want to share that love of it.
So start thinking about that now. You'll have about a month and a half. We'd kind of like to have all those answers in by Christmas. And that you could, if there was something that came out that final week, because we're going to consider the stuff that comes out the final week as well, on the 27th of December, to make the list. If you want to wait until then, you can. But it'll be a challenge to make the show, because we're going to be really tight on time after that final week. So try to get all your answers in by Christmas. You have some time to consider and think about the stuff that comes out. You know, the stuff that's coming out in November, you want to give it a fair shake. So you can always put your preliminary thoughts on the forum and then edit them later. We'll never know, because I won't compile them until close to Christmas anyway.
Well, but also don't forget about the stuff at the beginning of the year. There have been a couple of gems up there. And part of the challenge I have putting my answers together for this stuff is remembering the stuff at the beginning of the year, having time to have read the stuff at the end of the year, trying to weigh them equally. You know, it's one thing if you've got a first issue that's just an amazing, perfect issue or whatever. Well, if it came out the last week of December, it's like, okay, that's cool, it's awesome, but is it going to stay like an awesome title or whatever? How does it pan out? Versus, it was awesome at the beginning of the year, maybe the title stayed awesome, maybe it didn't. How does that color your opinion of it by this point? It's, again, there's no right or wrong answers that way, but we try to to not shortchange comics that come out at any particular time of year when we do this.
Yeah, John does that through data-driven information spreadsheets and scoring. I do that from my little online diary of favorite comics. So it's a little different angle we're coming through, but you know, hopefully we don't forget anything and nothing awesome falls through the cracks.
For me, the challenge is I'm currently, again, about 200 comics behind, so whether I'm fully read up or not, there may be a few things that don't make the cut just because I haven't read them.
It might be the 11-month yearly comic spotlight.
If anyone has something that they think is likely to influence my picks or something, hey, have you read this title or whatever? You may want to catch up on it before you do your picks. That's not a bad thing. I mean, don't tell me what's going on in the book or don't spoil it or anything, but... You know, there's just so much coming out.
Yeah. When is Doomsday Clock slated to come out? Is that at the end of, is that in January or at the end of December?
I was thinking it was December, but ooh, I don't remember.
That's got the makings of the pedigree, at least, of a big time release.
Certainly does. Certainly does. Let's see. We're recording this on Thursday, November 2nd. This weekend is the preview spotlight, so it's too late to turn in your clips for that by the time this goes up. But the following Saturday, November 11th at 7 p.m. Central Time is going to be the monthly comic book page teleconference. Last time it was just me and Randy, which was great. I had an awesome discussion with him. A lot of fun. If you're going to make it, post on the forum. If you're not going to make it and whatnot, that's fine too. But if nobody's going to make it, I can go, like, watch a movie or read some comics or other stuff. But if somebody's going to be there, I'm happy to be there. Just set my expectations. That's all I'm asking. And if you think you're going to make it and it turns out you're not, just update the thing on the forum. That's fine. It's no commitment. It's just, it's so lonely to sit by my computer by myself. And again, it's getting to be a busy time of year, and I get it, with kids in school and having stuff going on and whatnot. So it's, if you can make it, great. If you can't, fine. That's fine too. The preview spotlight deadline for December is going to be December 9th. I am expecting previews to come out on November 29th, and therefore a week and a half later, that bright and early that Saturday morning, December 9th, would be when the cutoff is. There should be plenty of fun stuff to find. There's just so much coming out as I keep discovering. It's a good time to read comics. There's plenty to read. There's tons of stuff to enjoy. I think no matter what you're interested in, if you're not finding something you're loving, describe what you want to find that you think you'll love and we'll help you find it. Some people are into superhero comics. Some are into more, independent kind of a stuff like over at Image or Back Half type stuff. There's nothing right or wrong about it. It's just finding the right title for everybody. It takes some work sometimes, but it's really rewarding when you do it. So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
That will do it.
Cool. Join us next week as we discuss Black Lightning Cold Dead Hands number 1 from DC, Black Bolt number 7 from Marvel, and Atomic Robo Spectre of Tomorrow number 1 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.